This is File 55. This is Jane McMillan interviewing John Mongeau of 231 Main Street, Lakeville, Connecticut. He is going to talk on several different things. Today's date is July 22nd, 2013. We'll start with easy stuff. What's your full name?
John C. Mongeau.
And your birth date?
October 6, 1946.
And where were you born?
In Westfield, Massachusetts.
Your parents' names?
Mary Shea and George Mongeau.
And Shea is S-H-E-A?
S-H-E-A, correct.
Do you have siblings?
Yes, just Therese Wheatley is my only sister. She's about 10 years older than me.
And that's Teresa Wheatley?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what is your educational background?
Okay, I had a B.A. from American International College in Springfield. I got my M.A. from Trinity. And that was in English as well. And then a whole bunch of other credits, probably 90 or 100 or so, from University of Hartford, UConn, WestConn, and Central Connecticut.
How did you come to the area?
We came here because, well, when we were... had graduated. I was going to be an English teacher at the high school level, and my wife was going to be an elementary school teacher.
At Salisbury Central.
But, the reason we came here was because one of her best friends in school was a secretary to the superintendent of schools.
And that was
Pat Allen. Who is now with Pat McCarran. Mm-hmm. And so she said, why don't you guys come out here and interview? And we did, and we were both able to get jobs. It was really wonderful.
You were fortunate.
Oh, yes.
All right, we're going to start with the work-study program of Regional 1. Who started it?
Okay, it was started by Edward Kirby. He was the principal of the high school at that time. And Peter Dakers and Betsy Hellman, I think it was the name, yeah. They were the two co-directors that really began the program.
Okay, and that was, you worked at that program?
I worked at that starting in 1974 through 1982. I think it started probably around 1971.
All right. Did you have to have certification for it?
Not certification. I had to be a certified teacher, but then I had to have another, I think it was 15 or 20, probably 24 credits in labor law, labor safety. It was like work study is what it was. It was in the... occupational ed curriculum over at Central.
What was the purpose of this program?
So that I would know that, I would be certain that when I placed a student in a job, that it was a safe job, that it was appropriate for that student, that OSHA rules are being followed and things like that. I mean, just labor laws primarily for kids because, you know, they were all usually under 18 years old.
And how did it operate? What was the structure beneath this?
Okay, the structure was for students who maybe were going on to college, may most likely not going on to college, when they got to be seniors, to give them an option so that they could have some occupational coursework. They would take regular academic coursework, and they would have then one class period a day with me about like work study, work habits, and things like that. It was a regular curriculum for that. And then they went to their jobs. We placed the kids on jobs in areas that they were interested in, where they could get some experience and maybe end up with a real job after that at this local employer. And that was in all six towns in Region 1. And so the kids would, I think they were in school pretty much all day Monday. And then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, they were in school until noontime. Then they went to their jobs until 4 or 5 o'clock. They worked the afternoon at their jobs, and in many cases, they worked Saturdays, too.
How was this assessed? Was there a form? Was there supervision?
Yeah, there was I had to, legally, at least once a month, I had to see the students. I mean, that was the bare minimum, see them on the job. What I would do is pretty much... I had, say, 40 or 50 students, so I would divide them up and, do 25 a week. And I would see each student then twice a month. I'd spend, you know, a good hour or so at their work site, wherever they were. And that would be part of my whole afternoon was doing that. And a lot of Saturdays and Sunday times, too, if they were working. Whatever days they were there, I had to show up some of those days. And part of their grade was given by their supervisor.
Who were some of the people involved in this, either as administrators or the businesses that these people worked with?
Oh, the business, and pretty much every one of the towns had a business that, or businesses that were involved in. So I'm just trying to do a sample here while I'm thinking about it. And, well, for instance, in Lakeville, I mean, there were some of the garages, gas stations.
Like Dufour's.
Dufour's, grocery stores.
Babe Jones.
Yep.
Okay.
Who was the other guy? Frank Bogue, his place over there. We had kids who worked at some of the banks.
Mm-hmm.
Noble Horizons was always a big employer, and they spent a lot of time educating the kids on all of the safety features that they had for running a facility like that.
Oh, great.
You know, for the operation of fire equipment, elevators, all that sort of thing. So, I mean, the kids really got an orientation over there, what work is really like. I had some students in the Falls Village area who worked at what was then Serenity Hills.
Oh, yes.
Now it's called Mountainside. It was the Alcoholic Rehab Center.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some students who had some difficulties with alcohol, who were getting some counseling services over there for free.
Oh,
but they were working there.
That's a wonderful
option. Yeah, it worked really nice. And in many cases, where kids worked in restaurants, that was their lunchtime meal. They could go have lunch there, or dinner, too, if mm-hmm. they worked later, and, you know, as part of their working shift or whatever. And they got paid at least minimum wage.
Which back then was probably... $3.50,
something like even less than maybe like $3.20.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And if they worked on it, I had some kids who worked on agricultural places like farms because they weren't in VOAG, but those are places that would help them
and
would
take
them.
They
needed it, and they were getting like $2.35 an hour. I mean, that was really pretty low. But that was a wage.
But that was a wage,
yeah.
And a wage is better than no wage.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you're learning, which is a bonus.
Right.
You had a wonderful story about Norm Sills and George Kiefer and a bucksaw.
Right. We had, this was actually during, we had this Summer Youth Employment Program, which is sort of an adjunct. I can talk about that later. But
yep, that's coming next.
Yeah, okay. We had a group of students who were working in the Appalachian Trail, maintaining the trail. They were working with Keith Bond and I think it was David Lindsay from the high school. They were their on-site supervisors. And they were probably 10 or 11 kids. And it was very hard work. And it was a hot summer like this. It was miserable up there. And I guess it was the CLMP had given us a stand. There was a acreage where they had some red pine trees. They were like smaller than telephone pole size. And they weren't going to use them. They maybe had some bugs or something like that. So they were going to let us take as many of those down as we could. Everything had to be done by hand with handsaws. And we're going to use those for some Adirondack shelters the kids are going to build up in the Appalachian Trail. And so George and Norm were showing the kids how to use these great big, like 6 foot long buck saws, two-man saws. And, you know, the kids weren't really putting a lot of oomph into it until finally George said, "Get your butts up in the air and pull. I want to hear that saw sing." And, you know, from that they went, okay, this guy is for real here.
Oh,
this
yeah.
This is serious.
Oh, yes, this is serious.
And then after they had cut all the trees down, then we had special bark spurs that they had to take all of the bark off the trees.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I've used that.
I mean, those are hard work.
Yep.
And then load them in the trucks, and then probably they built some sort of a trolley. It was like a cart that you could carry these mm-hmm. long logs on.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to take the logs up one at a time up the Appalachian Trail to the sites for we're going to build the shelter. And then we had an expert from the Appalachian Mountain Club came and spent probably a week with the kids up there. You know, he'd go up every day and he'd be with us and showing them how to cut the logs and notch them
mm-hmm.
with an axe and then make the shelter, how to orient it towards it so it would get as much sunlight as possible. And I think some of those structures are still there.
Naturally, they were done right.
Mm-hmm. Probably the worst thing they had was to... they had to go dig some outhouse holes.
Ah, yes, lalas.
And, yes. And put in, they wanted, I guess we put in plywood around it, you know, for modesty or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And up on top of Riga, I mean, it's just all rock.
Oh, that's
so
ledge.
We were just, you know, going through ledge
yep.
and using pry bars. It was just a nightmare, but they got it done, and they felt good about it afterwards.
Anything else that you'd like to talk about the work-study program before we go on to the summer youth program?
Okay. Actually, the work-study, one thing that I had forgotten about, that the work-study program was for just for seniors, primarily, at the high school. And it was working out really well. I mean, the kids were learning, they were making relationships with workers. Their bosses were like mentors to them. And Charlotte Reed said, you know, we have a cohort of kids in this town, in Salisbury, who need something like that, but they're too young for the program. I couldn't get them in there. So she worked very hard and got a federal grant from the Juvenile Justice Commission. It wasn't a lot of money. It was only about $15,000 to $18,000 a year. It was a three-year grant. And it was for I think there were 10 to 12 kids in Salisbury who were just going into the high school. They're going to be, you know, freshmen there. And they were pretty much all either adjudicated delinquent or they were heading in that direction. So if we used this fund of money for them, with the approval of the high school, we targeted the kids for just Salisbury kids, just those 10 kids. And they were going to do like the work-study program. They were going to spend their full day in school and then work at mentored work sites after school until about 6 o'clock, and then Saturdays. And what the program would pay for, the funding paid for their wage and the insurance and the coverage. So there was liability insurance and workers' comp insurance, so that a willing employer could take these kids on, and all we had to do was really teach them how to work and work with them, that the pay was taken care of by the fund. And some of the relationships were unbelievable. I mean, I know that Carl Franson and Doug Reed had an auto shop over in Salisbury, and I'm sure Charlotte pressured her son into taking on some students because he did a great job with it. But the kids would learn, you know, like auto mechanics from the bottom up. They would start them off with putting them in a corner with tools and have an engine on a big stand and say, okay, take it apart, ask questions, and you put it back together again. You know,
and don't have any pieces left over.
No pieces left over. And part of the deal was, the design was that, because I was in school with the kids, I would check up every day on the kids in school. I'd check up on with their teachers, how they were doing. I would visit the workplace and talk to the employers every day. And then I would talk to the parents pretty much every day. So if the student decided to stay out of school and go to work, I had to be the first one to know about that and get the triangle together so that the workplace knew that, okay, they didn't go to school today, they can't go to work. And it did, you know, I mean, anecdotally, we didn't do a lot of formal research, but it did help these kids. And it was, you know, it was Charlotte's tenacity that got this money and made it work.
Then it was Charlotte that was actually running this, or was it you?
It was me.
You were running
it. She took care of all the finances, and the town, I mean, they actually put these students on the town payroll, so they got their check from the town of Salisbury, you know, signed by all the, at that time, I think, all the selectmen and the town treasurer. They each signed the check.
Yeah, it's still done
that way. The same way.
And this program is still going on now.
No, this is just for adjudicated youth. These are just for, like, pre-delinquent.
All right, this is for at-risk students.
Yes, and that's over with now. The funding for that stopped. It was done just as a demonstration project to show the feds. The feds use it as part of their study that it did work. You have to have this, they call it triangulation, school, family, and employer.
When did it end?
It ended probably 1980.
Okay. Alrighty. And the youth work program that we have now is a different...
Right, exactly.
Because that takes everybody in Salisbury. They're not targeted
That's different, too. When we started that one, I was through my work at the high school. I got involved what was RESCUE, the Reeducational Service Center.
Oh, you're doing beautifully, because this is my next question.
The Educational Service Center came to us at Region 1 High School and said, you know, we wanted to do... It was a federally funded, through the State Department of Labor, federally funded program to provide summer work sites, summer work placements for kids who had economic disadvantage or academic disadvantage. So what they meant by that was either had to have your family had to meet certain poverty guidelines, mm-hmm. and the student had to either be physically disabled or seriously special education, really in need of some serious
really
academic services. And that was just for those kids. And we were able to do the five towns in Region 1 because Kent was in a different labor market. Kent kids had to work out of the Danbury labor market.
Yes.
Our kids are working out of the Torrington labor market.
Okay.
So when we started that, the very first year, Charlotte Reed said, it doesn't seem fair that it's only the disadvantaged kids. She said, I think any kid in Salisbury who wants a job should have one. So she went to some prominent families, I think three or four prominent anonymous families in town, and raised the money for the what was called the Salisbury Youth Employment Program for the summer. And the two of them meshed together. I mean, it was just, it was the perfect kind of a match.
It's a perfect marriage.
Public funds, private funds, and the town involved in it. You know, with the state labor department money, we were able to hire, like, worksite supervisors for these kids. So that you have a crew of kids, maybe 10 or 12, and they had somebody who was reporting to us, supervising them. So in Salisbury, the deal we made with them was that, okay, we're going to have so many kids from the state program, we're going to also have so many kids from Salisbury. The kids were just kids. They didn't know who was on which program.
And it didn't make any difference.
Didn't make any difference. Some got paid by a check from Litchfield, some got paid by a check from Salisbury. They had the same rate of pay, the same standards, the same same requirements.
The same requirements.
It was just, and really, I mean, we had places like, again, Noble Horizons was terrific. We had places where you could have congregate groups, like the Appalachian Trail was one. We had two supervisors paid by the federal grant. We had, I think, probably eight kids paid by the feds, four paid privately. The town provided the equipment, the town provided our supervisors with World War II or maybe Vietnam surplus four-wheel drive ambulance troop carrier mm-hmm. that they could use to carry the kids and all their equipment up onto the trail, any place they wanted to go. And every time it broke down, the town would send somebody up to haul it down and fix it. I mean, no questions asked.
Okay.
It was, and we had kids at, let's say, at Noble Horizon, Salisbury School, Salisbury Central School, Hotchkiss, Camp Sloan. It's wonderful. Silver Lake Conference Center. I mean, as far as we knew, there was no other marriage of private public funds like that in the state. And that was because of Charlotte. I mean, she wanted things done that way, and that was the right way to do it. And she put money behind it.
She put her money where her mouth was.
Yes, absolutely.
So if I have this correct, the rescue program was sort of the parent for the Salisbury Youth Program.
It was just,
in a way.
It was just the idea that,
was a spin-off of...
Yeah, because...
Everybody was that wanted to do this.
Exactly.
Could.
Everybody, even my own kids were involved. Every kid who wanted a summer job, there was a real, you know, more than just mowing somebody's lawn or whatever.
Yeah, or babysitting.
Babysitting. I mean, a real job.
This was a real job with work skills and pay. And this is the program that Patty Stevens now administers.
Yes, and David Beiersdorfer took it over after I left, and then Patty Stevens took it over. And as far as I know, it is still going. It's still going. It's funded by the town. I think there might be still private funds involved in it as well. I don't know. But it's just...
When this started with Charlotte, mm-hmm. how many students were involved?
Oh, I think there were at least 25 to 30.
Okay.
And we had probably that same number in the federal program, in the state program. Because, I mean, we had... So many kids, and then the ages for that were 14 through, I think they can go up to 18. We never had any kids really that old. But 14, when you're working with kids 14, you had to really be careful what kind of a worksite you chose for them.
Oh, yes. Did you have any children that were put in the library?
I believe so. I know we had some kids who did some work at the library. We had some kids who were physically handicapped who were able to, we got them over to... Sharon Playhouse, and they worked in the ticket booth over there in reservations.
Excellent. When I was working at the Scoville Library, we did have one student that was put there through this Psalm 3.
Yeah, I think the Historic Commission had some, obviously the town group. I mean, there were a lot of kids who worked there. There was always things going on. I think maybe they did some work at the... we had to watch out for unions, but that wasn't too much of a problem in Salisbury. You know, they wanted the kids to get a good experience, so people just went out of their way to help the kids.
And that's the way it still is.
Yeah.
People do go out of their way to help, whether it's kids or a program that they see that's valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything more that you want to add to that?
No,
part of it? That's it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's go to the church.
Okay.
Over in, is it Twin Lakes?
Yeah, it's Taconic, technically. But it's all solid. We call it Taconic.
Yes, I...
Yeah.
Okay, what is its name?
Okay, it's All Saints of America Orthodox Church.
And how many in the congregation?
I'd say probably 40 or so.
And the language of the Mass is...
Okay, it's English.
Rather than
Greek or Russian. I mean, it's American Orthodox, so the people come to that out of tradition of Greek Orthodox, Albanian,
mm-hmm.
Russian, Ukrainian, Syrian, but it's American, so it is in English.
Tell me about the physical building.
Okay, the building was built in 1930. I mean, I don't know when they started. 1930 was finished, and it was built by the O'Hara family, the O'Hara Construction Company.
Was it built as a Catholic chapel?
It was built as a Catholic chapel. It was called St. Francis Chapel. It was a summer chapel. And the story that we had heard through the O'Hara family was that it was around, the time of the Depression. And their construction company, one of the places they were working on was it's called Holy Ghost Orthodox Cathedral in Bridgeport. And they didn't want their men to go without work, so they brought the men up here, and they built the church.
Ah.
And when we got the church, it had been not really abandoned, it was just really kind of a mess. And we'd always thought it was owned by St. Mary's in Lakeville, and St. Mary's in Lakeville thought they owned it too.
Mm-hmm.
Until we got to the point where we were going to be able to buy the church, and they found out that it was owned really by St. Joseph's over in Canaan.
Oh, my.
So they had to get the two priests together and decide that they would sell it to us and split the proceeds. And neither one of them really wanted to get involved in it anymore. It was set up for people at the O'Hara Lodge so that they could have someplace to go and wouldn't have to come into town.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't winterized. It had some water in there and it had some electricity. But, there's no bathroom. There's no heat in there. There's no insulation. So there really was, it was kind of a detriment to them. I mean, they loved the church, they didn't want to tear it down, but they would want to have it to go to some good denomination that would be able to use it. So we got the church. I mean, over the years we've been adding to it. We had to put in a heating system. Right now we're in the midst of putting in some air conditioning after this horrible summer. We upgraded the electrical, put in septic system, a gigantic septic system.
Oh,
and bathrooms, and then renovated the entire inside and had it brought up to date, up to code, and then it all has all kinds of new icons in them. It's a gorgeous little place.
How big is the structure itself?
Structure is 30 by 60.
Okay, and how much acreage?
Only one third of an acre, so
that's
that's a problem. Yeah, there's not a lot of place to park. And at one point we were thinking, well, maybe if we were able to sell the church, we might be able to get something that would be a little bit larger, have larger land, that we could have a parking lot. And so we got a bunch of the realtors in town who were very helpful and said, you're not going to be able to sell this for anything other than a church, really. People really couldn't buy it for a house because the lot was too small. It really didn't have a lot going for it. So we said, all right, we'll stay with it as a church. And, it's a beautiful little structure, and people just love it. It's sort of a little baby cathedral kind of out in the wilderness.
Where specifically is it located?
It's located on Twin Lakes Road, about maybe 400 or 500 yards beyond O'Hara's Landing or O'Hara's Marina.
Oh, all right.
Can't miss it.
I've never been out there. I don't know.
Okay, it's the only little white church on Tannock Road.
Okay.
It's right at the base of Mount Hill Road where that comes down.
Fine. Who are some of the people that were involved with the renovation of this, I'll say?
Oh, the renovation of it?
Well, the development of it.
Okay, it was Father John Pawalczak, Pawelchak. And he was, I think he was from the Terryville area. So he was sort of a supply priest in this area. But the real start was Paul Leka, who was a music producer in Sharon.
How do you spell the Leka?
L-E-K-A. His brother-in-law, who was our priest now, Father John Kreta.
And how do you spell Kreta?
K-R-E-T-A. And this is before he was a priest. He was, he hadn't even been ordained, I don't think, as a deacon yet. But they wanted to, his family was from a big, big Orthodox tradition, a missionary tradition. His father was a missionary in Russia and in Alaska. And his father was the one who translated the Russian language service into English. So, I mean, they really wanted to get sort of an Orthodox presence in this area. And Hope and I got involved because I was Catholic. I went to St. Mary's Church, and she was Greek Orthodox. And the closest Greek Orthodox church we could go to with the boys is up in Pittsfield.
That's a hike.
Yeah. So we said, well, okay, we looked into it. And as the more we got involved in it, we had the services originally at Paul's house. He had a big mansion in Sharon.
Mm-hmm.
And then we found out about this church. We were able to buy it and then slowly renovated, cleaned it up, and changed it over the years.
What a wonderful project.
Oh, it was.
My brother-in-law, Henry Kiera, used to preach at the Union Chapel, mm-hmm. which was on the Green, and of course that got
torn down. Oh, yeah, right, yes.
So it's a wonderful sort of rebirth of a church in that area.
Yeah, when we went in, we had to, I mean, literally get rid of the squirrels that had taken up residence in there and all that kind of, and so it's been, and you know, it's an older building, it's constantly a lot of work, and I'm sort of one of the maintenance guys, but
that's right.
It's just, I love it. We love the church.
Oh, that's wonderful. Because it's so unusual to have a new, in quote, church develop.
Yeah.
And that's a marvelous, marvelous thing. We're going to go now to the fire district.
Okay, fire district.
When did it begin?
Began in 1905.
Why?
Well, there were some, I guess around that time, not only in Salisbury, but lots of towns in Connecticut, a rash of fires that just got out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the state legislature said, we've got to start developing some fire districts. They may have given money, I don't know. But the Lakeville Hose Company they were the hose company. They had the hoses.
Yep.
If there was a ladder company, they would have the ladders.
Oh, good.
That's why Lakeville's, their museum piece is this rolling hose thing that they have, mm-hmm. the hose carrier. And so they had the beginnings of the fire company, and they started the fire district. And that was the fire district, was really only in Lakeville. And what happened slowly over the years is things got more and more complicated. You know, we needed fire service in Lakeville, which you needed in Salisbury as well, and even in the outlying towns or villages. And
now, my historical background said that it started because the whole center of Salisbury was burned in 1903.
Right.
But yet this is a Lakeville entity.
They started it in Lakeville. I don't know why they didn't have a Lakeville and a Salisbury fire district, but it started in Lakeville.
And the purpose of it was?
For fire protection. Maybe because of the proximity to bodies of water.
It could be.
You know, because you had Factory Pond there and then the lake.
Yeah. What were the responsibilities?
Responsibilities were to provide fire protection. Originally, I think they had some sewers involved in there. They had street lighting, sidewalks, the footbridges in town.
Yep.
And it was always very confusing for people because people who were in the district, as it got more complicated and more expensive to run the operation, were saying they were thinking that their taxes in Lakeville were running the whole fire department. It wasn't. All of the money to run for fire protection, all that money came from the town. Mm-hmm. And the fire district was simply a fiduciary agent to run the money. We were the business office, say, for the for the host company because they couldn't handle the town money that way.
Sure.
They would lose their nonprofit status. So that even when they had to buy a fire engine, the money would come from the town to the fire district. The firemen would pick out the engine they wanted. The district, with town's money, they would buy the fire engine, and then the hose company would outfit it, which almost in some cases cost as much as the piece of apparatus.
Sure.
So that was kind of a nice, it was a very unusual
arrangement.
Kind of an arrangement. And then what we had to do was we had to get rid of, you know, as fire trucks aged out, mm-hmm. we would simply turn it over to the hose company and say, okay, why don't you sell this?
Yeah.
And then they could use that money, could go back into their fireman fund, for the hose company fund. And in the early, when I started in 1982 or 83, Chris Dakin was the chairman, and before that, the longtime chairman was Gordon Card. He was chairman for a lot of years. And they said it was a very small budget when we started, and as things got, like the cost of street lighting got to be like $25,000 or $30,000 a year. So we couldn't handle that anymore. We turned that over to the town. And then pretty quickly, the cost for renting the fire hydrants go way up from like $5,000 to $10,000, $15,000. Now it's up to around $50,000 a year.
Oh, my.
And we said, you know, and that was, we couldn't afford that anymore, doing it that way. So we had to do things differently. So, but when our taxes were very low, when I first started, we would have, our tax collector was Betty Trehune.
Oh, yes.
And she would sit out in front of the firehouse three Saturday mornings in July at a little table with a little card table, a little chair, folding chair, and sit out there and collect taxes from people that come and pay, usually in cash mm-hmm. or small bills. Because, mm-hmm. you know, people, the taxes were like, you know, $50, $25
yeah,
a year.
Something you could do.
Yeah. And then that changed abruptly. And, you know, over the past 10 years or so, there have been times that we've been looking at, you know, trying to phase out the fire district and get rid of it. And we were concerned about the relationship with the hose company. And as, you know, when the town finally got to the point where they said, we need a new firehouse, mm-hmm. luckily, they looked at, you know, where's the center of town fire protection-wise? Where the new firehouse is just outside the fire district.
Yep.
So at that point we said we can't be involved anymore. So we had to turn everything over to fire commission, which is fine. And then dissolve the fire district. We only finally completed that process. It's a very legal process last year because we kept screwing up things.
Okay,
doing things a little bit wrong. So it took us 4 years to get it right.
So it was actually dissolved in 2012.
Right.
And the new firehouse is on 4 Brook Street.
Right. That's
which
in,
is
it's in
right,
Salisbury.
It's in
right
Salisbury.
Over, right on the line.
Burton Brook, no, not Burton Brook, Moore Brook is the boundary between Lakeville and Salisbury.
Right. That was the boundary of the fire district. So,
okay.
You know, we had no choice but to put the fire district at that point out of business. Which
and what is
pleased everyone.
What's its new name?
Now it's called the Salisbury Fire Commission. And basically, part of that is complicated. All of the money that we use to run for the fire protection budget comes from the town. The only small piece that we have to, so we still bill out to people in Lakeville who are part of the fire district a small fee. I think it's $100, $150 a year for the fire hydrants in Lakeville. And that's only because it was set up that way a long time ago that the Lakeville fire hydrants, we got one bill from Aquarian. Actually, it used to be Lakeville Water Company,
uh-huh.
Bridgeport Water. Now
yeah.
it's Aquarian. They send us one bill, and we divide that out. In Salisbury, people are sent bills individually by Aquarian, people who have fire hydrants near their homes. And that, I mean, that they're trying to phase that out, too, because the Public Utility Commission doesn't want these big utilities to be sending out little bills. They'd rather have them send a bill to Salisbury and have Salisbury parcel that out in people's taxes. So there, because there are people in Salisbury who if they're not on, if they're not near a fire hydrant, really don't pay fire hydrant costs.
I'm not near a fire hydrant. I'm a private water company.
Yeah.
we don't technically have fire protection unless we use the pond or the bed of the Ore Hill line.
Yeah, and we have, that's why we have the big rolling, I don't know, 5,000 tanker, whatever, 5,000 gallon tanker that can bring water to the scene wherever it's needed.
Because that was one of the questions with insurance. But I'm with, at that time, I was within 3 miles of the firehouse. But of course, then you move the firehouse on
me. I know.
Which is all sorts of fun and games. Then their purpose is actually paying for the fire hydrants?
For the commission?
The
fire commission is the fiduciary agent for all the expenses for the hose company. All of the fire equipment, fire protection expenses. I mean, they take care of their own fundraising for their own purposes, like for scholarships, for, they run their chicken barbecues to give their money away, pretty much. And they give money, like I said, every time there's a new truck or new pieces of equipment, I mean, they outfit it with hoses, ladders, whatever.
Ah, okay. All right. Let's go on to the Grove Oversight Committee.
Okay.
Who started that?
That, I believe, was started by Ben Belcher. And, what was his name? Barnett.
Bill
Barnett. Because the Belcher family had given the land for the Grove initially.
No. They bought it from an offshoot of the Rudd family.
But then it was sort of given for the purposes of Salisbury Children. And then
and Belcher was involved in that part of it. But the actual property was an offshoot of the Rudd family.
So Belcher, when he was, Ben was always the pretty much the chairman of that, even when I've been on that for a lot of years.
And how long, when did you start on that?
I started on that probably 1975 or something like that. And we would meet only once a year for 1 hour on a Saturday. Because Ben said, he couldn't get business done in an hour. It wasn't worth it.
I like that.
And then, the Grove got more complicated. There are more features there. It's got larger. So we have a larger group. And we're still an advisory commission or advisory committee. I think we come under the Parks and Recreation Group, something like that. And we pretty much we advise on things like, the fees that we should charge for, people to launch a boat there, or membership fees, the sticker fees for people who are in town or not in town.
What's the purpose then? Just to see that it runs smoothly?
See that it runs smoothly, to provide, if there's, support that the Grove staff, like the Grove managers need, so the weekend, it just gives that person a larger group of people to talk to work with, if we're looking at things like how to raise money for a new playground.
It gives
us a group, and so we can, as a group, go to maybe Rotary or someplace like that and say, we've talked about this, that we can do this together. Rather than, the manager is, her day, or whoever's over there, their day is pretty much filled with day-to-day activities. Because there's so much that goes on over there.
And talking with Stacy, she said during the summer, sometimes it's a 60 to 80 hour
week. It's crazy. It's a beautiful facility, and it's getting a lot more pressure because there are people from other towns. There are school groups, summer school groups, that come all the way from Great Barrington, the Rudolf Steiner schools. They pay for it, but they'll send two or three student buses there because it's such a great spot for kids. They can have the waterfront, they can get in the shade.
And they don't have anything in Barrington because you can't use Mansfield Lake and you can't use Lake Buell or Prospect Lake.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't know that. Okay.
Well, again, it's a different area.
Yeah, and part of that committee that we took, part of the people on the committee became sort of the ad hoc committee that helped to work with the architects, work with the town to develop, and with the Committee on Aging to develop that new building they have over there.
Which is a beautiful building.
It's gorgeous. It's a nice facility.
And so that's what, in this area, that's our senior center, actually.
Right.
Okay. What are some of the responsibilities of the oversight? Really, it's just to make sure that...
Make sure things, like, we'll look specifically at things like staffing, like winter staffing, summer staffing, staffing for the waterfront for the lifeguards, training for the lifeguards, staffing for a little building, you know, the Grove House, sort of, you want to call that, when you go through there. We're involved in things like the cleanliness, we hope, of the factory pond, and we call it Kitty Pond. That's one of our goals right now, is to work with the town to figure out how we can get those little bodies of water cleaned up. They're just, they're mud holes right now.
Oh, yes.
And yeah, there's this, the rain and this terrible heat really haven't helped the situation any.
Not a bit. How many are on this committee now?
I think there are 10 of us now. And one of the, like, Stacy's one of the committee members, because she's the manager. Lisa McAuliffe, who is the director of recreation, she has to be on there. A bunch of others. Curtis is an ad hoc member. And so we have, not usually, usually not everyone can come to every meeting, but enough of us come that we can meet. We'll meet every other month for 1 hour. Thursday afternoon, 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock seems to work for most people.
I like that. If you can't do it in an hour, you can't do it. Right. I've been to a lot of faculty meetings that they couldn't get it done.
No, that's, and you know, like I said, we look at fees, we look at, one of the biggest, not a bone of contention, we've been really fighting with over the past few years, is how to have a traffic pattern at different times of the year when the kids are there, how to get people into the Grove, you know, by that far gate, but still have a gate so that you can maintain, use it as a gate and keep people out who don't have stickers, or make them pay if they're going to come in without a sticker. And because it gets very congested down to the Grove store when you have people backing their boats in, kids, you know, going to the store, and trying to manage that and work with the Grove staff on how to make that work smoothly, because it's a tough problem.
Now, you told me a story, and I think this piece of timber is in the Grove building, about George Kiefer and the yellow oak.
It was a yellow oak. This is only 2 years ago. The new building had been built and finished, and there was, I think George, pretty sure he called it a yellow oak, was this gigantic tree that came down with a microburst or something like that. It didn't take many other trees around it, but this one big tree fell down, narrowly missed the Grove building. I mean, it was just... So then they were able to, you know, cut it and get it out of there and grow, and it was a perfectly healthy tree. And that's when George told us about there was a rare yellow oak. And he took the time, he had a slice of it cut, and counted all the rings, and then measured, put little pinpoints at certain, you know, rings of, like, I think the beginning was, it was pre-Pilgrim, I think. And then landmark dates in there. So then they had, I think there was shellacked and preserved. So the people can see, look at, you know, where the growth rings are and what was happening in the world at that point. It's just, it's amazing.
And somebody like George would be able to do that.
Right. And George and Curtis worked with, I think it was with the Boy Scouts and with Stacy.
And Stacy.
And they started, you know, a bunch of acorns and made little saplings from this tree. And
well,
then...
Those were white oaks.
Those were white oaks.
So I'm not sure whether it's a white or yellow.
I know they're going to make a bench out of it, something like that, too. And use the wood. I mean, it's hard to mill and it's hard to dry it out. But, I mean, that was... And anytime we had anything to do with the trees, when we're looking at the Grove building itself, the old Grove building, we want to get rid of that... We couldn't make it much larger. We had to stay within the footprint because of the trees that were around it. So that's, the architects had to stay within the footprint. They put a cellar in there, which was could give them more space. But because, you know, those, I think Curtis called it, Curtis and George said it's one of the oldest stand of native oak trees
in the state. It's the oldest one in the state. And that's why they wanted to preserve it. And to have these new saplings. Because I got that story from Stacy, and then when I did my interview with Curtis and I asked him about it, he grinned from ear to ear and gave me more information. So you're verifying of the two other interviews that I've done. Now, tell me about the Bissell Fund. Who started that one?
The Bissell Fund, that was started by, they were admirers and friends of Dr. Bissell. And it was started, I think it was around 1915, 16, around the time just before his death. because they wanted to honor him as, you know, one of the premier doctors, I think one of the very first doctors in town. And the purpose was that he always wanted to have a fund available so that people who didn't have insurance, didn't have the money, could get medical service. He wanted to have a bed, a Salisbury bed available at Sharon Hospital. And, you know, ways for people who didn't have the means to help pay for their health care. Mm-hmm. And it was started, I believe, the initial part of the fund was $1,200.
Good heavens.
And a long time ago. And then...
Yeah, but that was a lot of money back then.
Oh, yeah. And then it just, you know, started growing over the years, and they were...
And I'm assuming the money was invested, and they're using the...
Just trying to use the interest.
The interest.
But even now, that had to change because life, the world changed.
Yeah.
The rules for tax-exempt foundations changed, mm-hmm. you know, maybe 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we're at a point where, you know, when I joined the VISA board...
And when did you join that?
Maybe 5 or 6 years ago. I think that's when it was. When I joined, when I was asked to join the VISA board, I mean, it used to be a much larger group, and they would get together and, I guess, as I understand it, to talk about people who needed mm-hmm. services. With the advent of the HIPAA legislation, you know, health privacy, yep. couldn't do that anymore. And which is fine. That's the way it should be. You know, when Patrice McGrath, the social worker, would come to us once a month, we didn't know who was receiving services.
Is she the gatekeeper?
She still is, right? We would just find out, you know, that we had set aside this much money to be spent for the health services. Primarily, it was like dentists, some doctors, a lot of prescriptions, you know, where people mm-hmm. couldn't afford those at the various
seminars. So it would be medical expenses, whether it was prescription or vision or hearing.
Yeah. We even did one. We had worked with, I guess, one of the veterans organizations to help put one of those Stairmaster things in somebody's house,
okay.
because that was the only way it could happen. But anyway, as the foundation rules changed, we were in a position where we were getting taxed. We were going to be taxed out of existence over time, and we didn't want that. So we figured out a way that we were able to, with the town's blessing, the town had to work with their attorneys on this. We were able to turn the fund over to the town. So then it's managed by Joe Cleveland and I guess through Salisbury Bank and Trust, through the Trust Department. Mm-hmm. And now it can be used, you know, in perpetuity, we hope.
Oh, good.
So that we meet I think we meet quarterly now. And the only thing there is a small board, I think there's 3 of us as an oversight committee. And we just hear reports from Patrice and over that quarter of the year, how many people were helped, how much money was spent.
So names aren't involved. It's just
no names,
data.
No, just data. Not even, you know, we could even find out if she wanted, she would give us the names of the pharmacies. We don't really care.
Yeah.
We just, you know, we set aside this much money so that this much is available on a monthly basis.
Who's on the board besides you, John?
Dr. Hayhurst, Bill Hayhurst. Mm-hmm. What's his name? Denise Rice, who used to be our treasurer, so she's still sort of treasurer, and myself. And Joe is the fiduciary agent for the town. And so, and he sees to it with Salisbury Bank and Trust that the money is invested very carefully. And we can take from the interest, but we can take a little bit more interest now because it's doing better.
Good.
But it's, you know, now we're hoping and sure that's going to be there for the long term, because that's what the original purpose was.
Yeah, to help people that couldn't help themselves.
Right, and I think other towns have something similar to this, but...
I'm not sure.
No,
I mean, we're a pretty special town.
We try to get this now. It's when we made the changeover, we tried to get it into the town report so that people know that they can still donate to this. It's still tax-exempt if they donate to us. And that money will go into that fund and be managed. And every now and then someone dies, usually some older person who remembers the VISL fund.
Mm.
And as part of bequest of their will, the money will go in there. And it's just for, and like with for the needs of Salisbury people. Like in some cases, even if we find out they've moved away,
Ah, okay.
And they still, you know, not too far away, and they still have needs and still a hardship we can help out.
Wonderful.
And they just approach Patrice as the gatekeeper.
You had a wonderful story about Dr. Bissell going up to Mount Riga.
This is in the Lakeville Journal a long time ago, and I think it went back to one of his, I think it was a real story. I don't think it was ephemeral. He had, I guess, a reputation for being just, you know, delivering babies in people's homes and things like that. And there were people up on Mount Riga. It was in a blizzard at night, and they needed a doctor. And he went up there with his buckboard and his old trusty horse. I mean, I wouldn't go up there with a car or a truck. Now, and they said that the people didn't know who he was, and they were shooting at him as he was coming down at night. And he said something about he didn't think he would go up there again in the dark.
That makes sense. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to this interview?
The only thing I'd forgotten about was the not the work study program, the youth program for the adjudicated youth that we had, the one that Charlotte started with the juvenile justice money.
Okay.
One of our first people who served as an employer mentor, we had a student who was interested in being a forester, and he spent his afternoons and his weekends with Curtis Rand.
Oh, good.
Yep, Curtis spent a lot of time teaching this kid, you know, what the work of a forester is all about.
Oh, that's wonderful. We got into it a little bit because I had done woodlot management when I was in England as part
okay.
of my sabbatical.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I knew something about it from the English point mm-hmm. of view, and he was quite pleased that I knew a little bit about
yeah.
forestry. John, thank you so much for
okay.
your time and
You're
your information.
This was fun.
Good.